Welcome to In the Layers, where we explore the people and technology behind artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Ron Green, and I'm very excited today because this is our special AI Year in Review episode. We're going to take a step back to reflect on the most significant moments, breakthroughs, and challenges that shaped the AI landscape this year. Joining me are three of my incredible Kung Fu AI colleagues, my co-founder and distinguished engineer, Zizi Tsai, AI strategist, Emma Prochowski, and VP of Engineering, Michael Wharton. I'm going to get their thoughts on the most important developments cutting through the hype. So get ready for some candid reflections, bold opinions, and even a few predictions as we explore this year in AI. Let's get started. All right, let's jump in. Zizi, Emma, Michael, I'm really excited to cover 2024 in AI. And I want to kick off by talking about what each of you think were the top three sort of most important developments from your perspective. And you're coming at this from pretty wildly different perspectives. And I think we would all agree that this year was the craziest year yet in a long line of sort of crazy years in AI.
What a year.
Yeah, exactly. So let me start with you, Zizi. Anything you want to, you get to pick three things. What's your first important development in AI you would call out?
It's going to be open source, large language models. Because I remember back in 2023, the end of 2023, the open source large language models are still way behind the commercial ones like ChatGPT. But in a year we have Mistral, Llama, Omo, and so many others that's like quickly catching up in the quality.
Yeah.
And so this is just the base LLMs. In vision language models, there are also similar trends, maybe even more so, like the open source ones are really close or even surpassing the commercial ones.
I know, it's crazy.
So yeah, that's my top one. I'm curious.
Spoiler alert, that's also one of mine.
That was going to be one of mine, but I went a totally different direction. I'm glad you did.
Yep. Okay, Emma, what's one of your top three most important developments?
So this year was a really big year for AI regulation, as I'm sure we all know. So mine is starting in that arena with some significant things coming out of the EU. So the EU AI Act went into force of August this year. It was initially proposed in 2021. So it's been a very, very long time coming. A lot of people have been waiting for this. And essentially, it defines a risk taxonomy and classification system for AI systems, also defining prohibited use cases, high risk, moderate, and low, and basically outlines certain obligations and requirements that companies have to follow, both developers and deployers, but it does put a little bit more liability on the developers of these systems. And so some of the practices include things that we're very familiar with, like transparency reports, safety testing, and things like that. But it'll be really interesting to see what kind of impact this has, of course, not only in the EU, but also in the US, knowing that, AI systems don't really know
boundaries. Borders.
Yeah, exactly. And then additionally, the product liability directive came into force on Sunday. So just a few days ago.
Oh, and this is
kind of a somewhat companion piece of regulation, although it is a directive, so slightly different. But basically, it defines certain liability requirements for companies to follow. And it so the manufacturer has to compensate damage caused by a defective product. And what's interesting is an AI system is included as a product under this definition. I know there's been some debate around whether or not it's a product, if it's something else. So within this directive, it's included. And then the victim has to prove that the product was defective and that the product's defectiveness is what's result in the damage. What is also really interesting about this, in some ways, how I'm reading it is it's kind of an enforcement mechanism for the EU AI Act, because if I'm a technology provider and my system had some sort of damage that resulted in harm or a risk, and I'm not following certain obligations as outlined in the EU AI Act, the court can presume that the result of that damage was because of my inability to apply these certain practices.
Okay.
So super, super impactful piece of, you know, regulation on both fronts that I think provides a lot of motivation for enforcement and incentives for companies to start adopting.
Do things like language model hallucinations, would that fall under product failures? Or?
So I think that would mostly be on the deployer of the tools, because that's like a known limitation of you know, generative AI. And so in that case, which one example that I'll get into a little bit later, we've seen a lot of chatbots kind of gone wrong this
yes,
year. And yeah, I think hallucinations would probably be on the deployer to kind of manage to make sure that they're appropriately relying on the tool.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
Fascinating.
Yeah. All right, Michael, what do you have for us?
I am so glad that ZZ and Emma had those two answers, because that I think those dovetailed perfectly into what I was going to talk about. I was going to talk about exactly what you mentioned, ZZ. I think it was a really big year for open source, and particularly Llama 3 and just the whole, you know, like
totally
Zuckerberg open source revolution to just stoke all this competition in the industry. And I'm increasingly of the mind that, you know, a balance of power and healthy competition is something that's going to ultimately really end up with like a more safe outcome for whatever may be ahead of us.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
And ideally, you know, we would roll things out really slowly like they have been in the EU.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, what I'm really excited about that you mentioned, Emma, is that the EU AI Act is out there. It's in full force. And actually, Llama 3 was not deployed in the EU because of how restrictive they typically are.
That's right.
And in an ideal scenario, we would have this really slow rollout where, you know, we're more deliberate, more intentional, and we're avoiding risk. But that's just not the world we live in here in the U.S. And yeah, I think this balance of power that Zuckerberg's oddly at the center of, I think is kind of an interesting turn of events. And I'm happy that it ended up that way.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Yeah, I totally agree. I've said this before, but if you had told me that of all companies, you know, Facebook, Meta, Zuckerberg would have, you know, come to the rescue of this sort of AI future and help democratize it, I wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah, the center of open source.
Yeah, didn't see it coming.
Yeah, and you know, by the way, I read a couple of weeks ago, Young LeCun was said that they are training Llama 4 right now, as we speak, and they're training it on 100,000 H100s. GPUs. So that's about 3 billion.
Can I borrow one?
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's 3 billion hardware. So it's just astounding. Okay. All right. I'm going to go back around. Each of you get two more. ZZ, what do you have?
So my second one would be, I heard some people say 2024 is the year of agentic AI, which I agree because there are so many RAG solutions, you know, the retrieval augmented generation and, you know, computer use, etc. But to me, the most that I think 2024 is the year of multi-modal, meaning, you know, it's going beyond just text as a generation output and also input, but also incorporating image, video, being able to take that as input and also output. So we see a lot of great commercial and open source models for image generation and video generation, protein generation. You know, it's just kind of exploding in terms of the modalities of the data. So Sora just finally general available, 2 days ago, I think. Yep. I'm already playing with it.
You've got access to it already? I haven't.
Oh, if you have a Plus account, like the regular account, you have it. I can talk about it more later.
But, okay, that's great. I completely agree about the multimodal stuff. How much do you think that the reason we're seeing this explosion of multimodal is because the unification architecturally using transformers?
I totally agree. I think that's a great point. So, I mean, the invention of transformers really enabled, AI machine learning to be easily applicable to different type of data.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, from text to image, you only need to change the tokenizer.
Right.
And then once everything's tokenized, you pass it into transformers and then, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Audio, same thing.
Yeah.
It kind of blows my mind that you can just take image embeddings from a completely separate trained image architecture and just put in this little connector that converts it to tokens, and then all of a sudden everything works. It's pretty magical.
Yeah, you're off to the races. Yeah,
everything's a token.
Yeah. All right, Emma.
All right. So staying on the regulation kick, this October was the 1 year mark of the Biden administration's executive order that went into place with AI. And so this basically outlined requirements for federal agencies in the AI domain. I believe they all appointed a chief AI officer, among many other requirements. And so on the 1 year anniversary, they announced sort of an update on where they're at. And it was a list of, it included a list of over, I believe it was 100, if not more, basically actions that had been taken across all of the agencies in compliance with the U.S. executive order. And this includes things like the U.S. AI Safety Institute came out of the Department of Commerce, signed agreements regarding AI safety with both Anthropic and OpenAI. So this is around, certain transparency requirements, red teaming, communicating to the government around their training of really large models and things like that, and also required ongoingly quarterly reporting from here on out. There's, of course, a lot of questions around what will happen with the executive order in 2025.
That's what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, with the new administration. There was actually recently a letter written by Senator Ted Cruz to the Attorney General Merrick Garland. And so, I guess to back up for a second, in 2024, there's also been a huge development from a global AI governance standpoint. A lot of safety institutes that have been created, a lot of stuff that came out of the UN General Assembly, and just kind of this recognition that AI, as we mentioned earlier, knows no boundaries. And so it's going to have a global, it already is having a global impact. And so if we want to appropriately regulate and govern it, we really need to collectively think about how are we advancing safety practices? You know, what are we agreeing to? Where do we not want to be using AI? And in many ways, this letter, I think, criticized the U.S.'s involvement in some of that from the perspective of if we have global or foreign governments helping inform our own policy and our own limitations potentially that we place on innovation from a regulatory standpoint, that could pose national security threats.
Right.
It could impact our ability to innovate and remain competitive, which is obviously a really big priority for the new administration. So it's not, I think it would be, I don't know. I'm curious to see, as there's more and more global work in the AI governance space, what it would look like if the US were to back out of that. But I think regardless, when you look at all of the actions that have been taken over the past year across the government, I mean, these practices are very clearly embedded in all government work with AI. So I think that the impact there regardless will definitely continue.
Do you think the coming administration might unwind some of these new policies that are barely, a year old?
I think they could. So, from the perspective of the executive order, a lot of the governing bodies across the federal agencies have already been stood up. Mm-hmm. And so whether or not, like, how that would actually play out, I'm not entirely sure. There have been discussions around kind of walking back the executive order. But, and this kind of getting into one of my other ones, there's really a lot of like state regulation as well. There's a lot of incentives that are coming even from not just regulatory pressure, but company pressure as well. So as we think about like third-party vendors, given so much more liability is often on the deployer of the tool, typically there's the need to do like really robust vendor assessments. And so that also offers some incentives for the developers of the tools to be following practices, even if it's not mandated.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
All right, Michael, what do you got?
We should talk about some Nobel Prizes, I think.
Good.
Ooh, there we go.
I like this one already.
Yeah. I think that, so for those listening that aren't familiar, Jeffrey Hinton and John Hopfield, two key formative contributors to the field as we know it, they got Nobel Prizes this year. And I think that alone is impressive, but I think it's more the signal that it sends that I'm really excited about. I think it, you know, when I think back to 3-4 years ago, when you talk about AI at parties and you say, oh, I'm an AI, really it doesn't land like it does today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a niche.
Yeah, it's like, oh, it's niche. That's like, yeah, it's kind of interesting, but I don't really know what you're talking about. And then now it's almost impossible to imagine a world like that. It's kind of crazy how much has changed in that amount of time. And I think so much has been advanced in terms of scientific discovery, especially in the last year. You know, Google's DeepMind, I think, is kind of at the forefront of this.
Totally agree.
AlphaProof, AlphaFold 2 and 3. You know, we got GenCast that just came out last week.
That's
revolutionizing
right.
how we predict weather even.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
There's so much advancement going on. And I think to see that sort of public recognition of the legitimacy of AI as a tool to advance scientific discovery, I think it's just this turning point, I think, where everyone and their dog needs to know about it. I mean, if you are a citizen of the world, it's something that you should know at least a little bit about at this point. And I think that was just an important signal.
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny. I have lots of friends who, you know, I've known for years during, you know, my entire tenure in AI, and for the longest time they thought I was crazy. And so, you know, it's kind of nice that we have this validation now. Long time coming. I mean, for me, it's been, you know, decades in coming that it's finally here. And we're doing
AI winters. You're done with them.
I think we're generally done with the AI winters. And what I really love about the Nobel Prize stuff is I think it also signals that there's a little bit of a shift in science. I genuinely believe this. I think that the work on AlphaFold around protein folding, as you all know, I'm really passionate about. I think it's going to change how we do science. AI is going to change fundamentally how we do research and how we advance pretty much every field. If we can solve complicated problems like the, you know, one of the biology's grand challenges, protein folding, there's pretty much, and weather, right?
Yeah.
Famously chaotic. There's almost nothing that AI won't be able to affect and move in a positive way, in my opinion.
Couldn't agree more.
All right. Okay, ZZ, you have one more. What's your third sort of important AI development that happened in 2024 that you would call out?
It's kind of related to image and video generation, but it's world models. So I think one of the major bottleneck of large language models is that it lacks a world model. It doesn't really understand the world, the causal relationships, like what's behind the data. I think the world models, you know, towards the end of the year, we see Genie 2 from Google DeepMind, I think. Also World Labs, you know, Fitbit's new startup, and also there are several similar ones, like, you know, I think from Yan Li Kun, you know, his group came out with a new paper called the navigable world models. Mm-hmm. So all of those feel like similar to video games, but really it's a video generation models conditioned on user controls. So this is a really exciting area. So like imagine if you can train great world models, that would be very supplementary to the capabilities of the current language models.
Right.
So I'm really excited about this direction and hoping to see more development in the coming year.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what are some like potential use cases that you think could come from world models?
That's a great question. So for robotics, I think it's very useful because, mm-hmm. you know, if you can train the robotics in a virtual environment, put it in a virtual room or a virtual escape room, let's say, and let it explore freely and touch this, move that, and be able to learn things, that will be a much more efficient way to train the robotics rather than, you know, putting it in a real physical room where, you know, it's more expensive to set up. It's going to be more limited. So I think it unlocks data, which unlocks more capability from model.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, even if you build out simulations these days, it's still usually limited in some way. And to have just like a fully extensible world model, you could just plop a robot into and say, hey, go learn how to navigate the world and then deploy it on a real robot. Mm-hmm. That'd be pretty cool to see.
Yeah, the thing about the world models that blows my mind, I still can't get my head around, is how they sort of reverse engineer and essentially learn like physics and ray tracing and all of these sort of critical components that we have entire systems, you know, that have been built up over decades with really complicated code bases. And that sometimes, you know, if you think about ray tracing, you know, sometimes it can take hours to just, generate a single image in a movie. And these models are just apparently learning incredibly compressed representations that can run almost at real time. So it just blows my mind. That's the part about it that I would not have anticipated at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Emma, what's your last one?
All right. So admittedly, I have two. I'll tell you the themes and then maybe you're
breaking the rules.
You both could pick. You all could pick. So one is, I did a whole regulatory kind of theme for this. So another one is regulation related. And then the other one is kind of business related.
Well, all right, just do them both. Go for it.
Staying on the regulation kick. So there's been a lot of state regulatory action this year, particularly Colorado, Utah, and California. And early this year, the FTC announced a kind of an enforcement on the Rite Aid case. I don't know if y'all are familiar with the Rite Aid case.
No,
familiar
with that one.
So basically, Rite Aid used facial recognition technology in their stores. And this was, they worked with, I believe it was two third-party providers to build this. And the purpose was to detect individuals that would potentially be likely to exhibit some sort of criminal or suspicious activity. And so they trained these models on... I think it was individuals within that area that had a previous criminal history. And then also Rite Aid had their own database of individuals that had either committed criminal activity within the store or were suspicious.
It's like pre-crime?
Yeah, pre-crime.
That's no good.
Yeah. And as you could imagine, a lot of these images, especially in the Rite Aid database, were very low quality because they were like taken on a cell phone or something like that. And so, of course, there was a ton of, you know, biased, negative, awful output, profiling individuals and things like that. And so early this year, the FTC basically announced that Rite Aid could, there was a whole list of things, but it was like Rite Aid cannot use facial recognition for 5 years. And any data that they had gathered, I believe they had started this project, been using it since 2012. So this was a really long span of work that they had been doing, data that they had been gathering. They had to delete any data, any algorithms, any models associated with this use. And then if Rite Aid wants to use facial recognition after the five-year mark, basically outlined what the FTC would consider a good quality governance program for them to follow. Super significant for so many reasons, but I think the biggest one is in many ways, you know, in the US, we look at previous cases to really see what the precedent is. And so this kind of, in many ways, is like the AI governance playbook from the FTC of what they consider to be a good quality governance program. But I think it also shows just, you know, the FTC is
wow
is responding.
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about this. Yeah.
So, I feel like we're living in a. I feel like that's a great example that kind of confirms that. I think on the tech side, when we're all in the weeds doing the engineering,
right?
We have our newsletters, we have other people I follow, but for whatever reason, I don't think that made it into any of the news sources or anything I follow. It's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's just so much like regulatory action. I feel like that's a whole other world as well. Okay. And then the last one, this one's a little bit more quick. So on the business side, there is a 2024 State of AI report that came out from Menlo Ventures. And they found that 53% of companies sourced from vendors compared to 80% in 2023. So the other side of that equation is in-house development. So that means that a large percentage of companies have shifted to in-house development. I'd be curious to hear your perspectives and, you know, some speculations as to why. I imagine, one, you know, generative AI at this point, I think off-the-shelf generative AI solutions are kind of table stakes. And so a lot of companies have recognized that to really be competitive, they need to have differentiated solutions, which often requires proprietary data. But because there's, third-party vendors are difficult to assess for a number of reasons, IP, you know, many other things. Companies are moving towards doing them in-house.
Yeah.
Curious what y'all think.
Yeah, I just read the report too. I think that's it's a great one. And I think I saw a number that says the enterprise spend on generative AI kind of increased by 8 times from last year. So I feel like the trend is just going up crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So both like in-house and also by vendor are going up. And the trend is probably gonna continue.
Yeah. I would almost think differently just because I'm thinking about clients that we have that come to us that they have taken a lot of development in-house and they've done work on mm-hmm. usually generative AI based solutions. And then at the end of the day, they come and need a little bit of help because they're relatively easy to implement, but in terms of getting actual value out of it
right.
and, you know, making something that justifies paying those cloud bills, I think that that's been a little underwhelming. So I almost wonder if it's kind of like a short-term bump that we're seeing and it's going to follow that Gartner hype cycle a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I can't imagine that rate would continue, but I mean, I guess we can just wait till next year and see what the next report says.
Yeah, I think products like ChatGPT makes it easier to get started, but in order to realize the business value to right. make it really work in production, I think that still takes a lot of time and iteration.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That's right. I think a lot of companies dramatically underestimate the amount of work it will take to get any type of AI, and it's maybe even especially generative AI, to that production level quality, especially when you start taking in some of the new regulations that you mentioned that are coming into play.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Michael, what's your last really important event in AI that happened in 2024?
I thought it'd be good to talk about just this massive push toward efficiency. I mean, I agree with what Zizi said earlier about it being kind of the year of multimodal. I think that's definitely true. But there's also this other category of a massive amount of research and innovation that's going into pushing this Pareto frontier. We've continually started to talk about it. Zizi in particular has done a lot of awesome research on his own time into this with, you know, video generation, diffusion models.
Yes.
And I think that it's important to democratize access to these models. I mean, the fact that I can just get Ollama running on my local laptop and run a, you know, best in class small language model.
I love Ollama.
It's amazing.
I love it.
And it's so easy. It takes just a couple lines of code and you're
so
there.
Simple. Yes.
But I think not only around model efficiency, but we also have seen a lot of appreciation for the quality of data.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a couple of years ago, maybe that textbooks is all you need.
Mm-hmm.
Textbooks are all you need, rather.
Yep.
Paper came out.
Yeah,
you know, historically, those scaling laws, we've kind of treated all data points as being mm-hmm. equal in terms of value they provide for training.
Yeah.
But really what we're finding is that the more you refine that and really filter out either redundant data or data that doesn't really help with reasoning ability, you can get a lot of bang for buck out of just smaller data sets. And I'm excited to see that push and hopefully it keeps going. We'll see.
I am too. And we're seeing it kind of at both ends of the spectrum. We're seeing, you know, like we just mentioned that, you know, Meta is pushing Llama 4. They're training it on hundreds of thousands of GPUs. At the other end of the spectrum, you have things like Phi 3 from Microsoft,
yep.
and they're getting it down to, you know, sort of single billion parameter models, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that focus on higher quality data. I totally agree. I think that's a really, really big development this year.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the cost of training is coming down a lot over the last year.
Yeah.
I think by 10x at least.
Yeah, those GPT-2 speed runs are blowing my mind. It's crazy.
Yeah, I've been watching those. It's in real time. It's like coming down. Like the training a GPT in under 4 minutes now. Yeah. It's crazy.
Well, it's funny because when you started off your point of saying, you know, focusing on efficiency, my head immediately went to, from a business perspective strategy perspective of companies investing in, especially generative AI for, you know, to equip their workforce, of really being focused on, we see this a lot around, what is the value that I'm getting? What's the ROI? What are the mm-hmm. metrics for success, potentially even super early on? Efficiency from a different perspective.
That too, 100%.
Yeah. Yep.
Totally agree. Yeah, the cost of intelligence is coming to zero, as someone said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's switch gears. We were talking about things that were exciting that happened last year, things that we really liked or that we think were momentous. Let's talk about missteps. Let's talk about failures and mess ups. Each of you, just give me one failure in AI that you look back on in 2024 that really comes to mind. And I'm going to start with you, Emma.
All right. So mine's related to deepfakes. I think we saw a lot of deepfakes this year, especially celebrities, some really famous ones. But this example, it actually is from a company in Hong Kong. So a finance worker was at a multinational firm in Hong Kong's branch and basically was getting some communication from what he thought was the CFO.
Oh, I remember
was
that.
A little bit, this, was a little yeah. bit suspicious because I think they were having some communication about like a secret transaction or something, but joined a video call with six of his colleagues, had a conversation, and it turns out that the whole thing was a deepfake. And this individual transferred the U.S. equivalent of, or it was, I believe, $25 million U.S. dollar payout. So I think this is just a crazy case and really signifies like how advanced the technology is, how skeptical yeah. now we need yeah. to be of, yeah.
Yeah, what is reality?
yeah.
Yeah.
Those are terrifying.
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely.
All right, Michael, what's your top failure?
Okay, I'm going to cheat a little bit.
All right, do it.
So this actually happened in December prior to this year, okay. but it was pretty close, and it's kind of a theme that's played out. So I think when Google released their Gemini video, the what the quack thing mm-hmm. with the rubber duck that they're drawing on the paper, and yeah. You know, it showed this real-time multimodal inference that Gemini was apparently doing, and it turned out that afterward, it was staged, it was working on images rather than the video. You know, it wasn't happening in real time. It was all kind of marketing doctored. But I think that was kind of a stain on their technical credibility. And I'm actually surprised it didn't even get more attention than it did. It was...
I'm actually glad you're bringing this up because I was really disappointed in Google when they...
For sure, yeah.
Basically, you know, staging a demo that was... purposely misrepresenting what the state of the art was. I mean, that was not cool. I do think they've recovered. They've done some really great work this yeah. year, but that was disappointing. I was actually, at the time I remember thinking like, are they faking this because they've hit a wall? Like what's behind this? This isn't necessary.
Well, I think one of the reasons this is speculation, but I think that kind of confirmed that they felt rattled by OpenAI.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And it turned out in May, they did release GPT-4o, and did exactly that. They had real-time inference, and they showed with an actual edge with their phone
yep.
that they were doing this real-time inference. And I think that sort of teed them up for success. And you even look at the OpenAI marketing on their website. It's kind of cheeky. And what did they say? They said, all videos on this page are at 1x real-time. And that's like the yeah. only thing it says
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
It's like clearly 1x real-time. Maybe yeah. a little bit of a jab.
yeah.
But I think that it's taken Google a lot to catch up, and it, you know, it's really a competitive space now. They're not top dog anymore. And last week, I think, was the first time, if ever, that Gemini is at the top of the LMSIS leaderboard, yeah. The 1206.
That's what I saw, yep.
Model. So
yeah. Good
been
for
a long,
them.
Long road back.
It's a long road back, yeah. yeah.
And now it's much easier to get the API key from the AI Studio of Google Cloud now.
Oh, is
much
that right?
better than last year.
Yeah, that's good.
So they're scaling things up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it used to be very difficult to even get the API key because you need to go through several hoops
right.
and authentication, but now it's much easier. So yeah. their product is getting better.
Yeah. Yeah, they've recovered. Susie, what's your top AI failure of the year you look back on?
There's this $1 Chevy Tahoe.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you saw the news. Yeah. So it's the $1 Chevy Tahoe.
yeah.
So I think it's a chatbot on Chevy's website where the customer chatted, and then you know the chatbot basically says, you know, hey, you can have a Chevy Tahoe for $1, and it's I think it's maybe considered a binding offer.
right.
Well, the wording, I remember seeing this, I think it was in Palo Alto, and they were like, okay, and I need you to repeat this back to me, and you have to say no takesies backsies at the end of it. It was yeah. so funny.
Yeah. yeah. I don't think they actually got approved.
Right. right. I think they did dodge that. Oh, that's great. Okay. I've got another segment for you all. this is a little bit, again, sort of in the failure mode, but like, what is the AI buzzword that you kind of feel lost its mojo this year? Something that came into the year hyped and that we're exiting 2024 and it's not really, you know, it doesn't really have the momentum it had coming in. And I'm going to start with you, Michael, on this one.
If I see another paper that has "all you need" in the title, I don't know what I'm going to do.
That's exactly.
Was that going to be yours too?
Yeah, that's in my list.
But. Yeah, it's crazy because I was curious before this. I was like, oh, I'm going to have to talk about this. I looked up on Archive how many papers have that string in the title, mm-hmm. and it's 521. 521 papers have kind of jumped onto this. It used to be, I guess, a marketing cheat code in a way where you could kind of garner research credibility just by putting them in the title, but I think it's lost its mojo in a big way.
I read one time that the person that came up with the title in the original, you know, "Attention Is All You Need," there was a riff on the Beatles song, "Love Is All You Need."
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, that's where it came from originally, which I think is kind of cool. Yeah. ZZ, what buzzword would you call out?
Whenever there are new model released, you will see on social media, you know, here are 10 wild examples.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in the beginning, I really enjoyed those, but over the time, I feel like, you know, a lot of fatigue just seeing it over and over
just
again.
Just over and over
again. Kind of cliche.
I totally agree. And with every thumbnail on YouTube about AI having somebody's, you know, expression, their mind is blown. It's like, you know, not everything is unbelievably shocking every day.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I used to be afraid of, you know, missing an important model, missing an important trend, but things are going so quickly that, you know, if I miss some, you know, just wait a couple of months, it's going to be, you know, surpassed by a new one.
Just wait. There'll be something bigger.
That's a good point. I love it. Emma.
Mine is prompt engineer. I'm surprised nobody said that.
One,
I feel like especially like businesses where, you know, we're going to need to hire prompt engineers. It's going to be the new hot job.
Totally agree. Yeah, that's good.
And now it's like, no, you just, yeah, it's just a skill, but no.
Yeah. I know how to type. I'm a prompt engineer. Yeah. I love it. All right, let's switch. Let's do hot takes. And this is your take on something that happened in 2024 that maybe just is not accepted wisdom. It's your, you know, special view, your special hot take on something in 2024. ZZ, what do you got?
So it's not really my hot take, but something I read. So there's a lot of debate of whether LLMs have hit a wall. Mm. And I think there are a lot of opinion now that there's no wall. And I kind of agree with that because, you know, although the text data is kind of depleted in some way, but, you know, there are so many images and videos and so many other types of data from science. Really, I mean, text data is the most expensive form of data in the world because, you know, it's a measurement of the world through human brain in thousands of years. And, you know, human brain is required. So,
right.
And text data is really a highly condensed form of data of the world.
Right.
So why not, hey, let's just go to the raw, more raw format of the data, like images, videos, audios, you know, that's much cheaper and much more in volume. So I feel like, you know, there's probably a lot of room to keep scaling and get more intelligence. And in a related note, you know, the cost of intelligence, I do see it coming down to maybe not zero, but maybe the cost of electricity. I don't know. So we need to be ready for such a world where the intelligence is really inexpensive.
Well, I love that. And I think you hit on a really, really good point. And I think it's one of the reasons I'm still fairly optimistic about Google, because who's sitting on more video training data than anybody else on the planet? Google through YouTube.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%. Emma, what do you got?
All right. So my hot take is I think there's some governance washing going on this year. I think AI governance has some course correcting to do. And so I feel like in 2024, you know, a lot of companies have enacted AI principles, some sort of AI policy, and some sort of like business rules or guidance, partially because now AI is accessible to all of their employees. And so it's like a whole new kind of risk profile that companies are looking at. But I think there's still such a lack of like actually adhering to and implementing these things in practice. There was a report from the World Economic Forum this year, and they basically looked at a bunch of AI governance tools, and how they defined AI governance tools included like frameworks, scoring mechanisms. So it wasn't just like a product or software tool, although they looked at some of those as well. And they found that over 38% not only didn't result in a better product or mitigate risk, but actually introduce a new risk, which I think is just like a crazy number, over 38%. And so I feel like where AI governance really needs to get to is not just, you know, check the box, like, did we do a risk assessment? Did we do some sort of documentation? But actually being able to evaluate, are these practices resulting in a better AI product or a better AI solution? And there's, of course, initiatives like red teaming and AI auditing, which I think have gained a lot of traction in 2024, although, of course, they've been around for a while. But I feel like there's a lot of risk in companies communicating, oh, I have some sort of AI governance program, and communicating a lot of confidence and trust in that, but without really knowing if these practices are actually helping.
Do you, all right, I've got a question about that. Do you think they're doing that for perception reasons or for sort of legal liability coverage reasons? And they're maybe somewhat indifferent to the efficacy initially, but they're just trying to get out ahead of it a little bit? Or what do you think is driving this?
Yeah, this is such a complex topic, because AI governance is like relatively new. And so I think on one hand, we don't have a ton of really great practices for measuring, you know, how, like, what's the value of dodging a bullet?
Right.
And so there's less incentive mechanisms for companies to be adopting some of these practices beyond the surface level. And so I think most companies probably want to do the right thing, but there's not AI governance, I think, is still lagging behind in what's an effective, scalable way to do that. I'm sure there are companies as well that, you know, want to communicate, have responsible AI principles, I'm doing a great job, but, you know, behind closed doors, really just value getting to market.
Yeah. I definitely feel like most companies were under a lot of pressure to get AI into market, get something done to prove that they are going to remain competitive and embrace AI, and oversight and governance and regulation was sort of a second thought, right? It was not the main goal.
Yeah. Maybe Rite Aid's going to figure it out for us and report back.
Poster child. All right, Michael, what do you got?
Yeah, so I don't know about y'all, but I'm not really enamored by the AGI debate, and I think that's really picked up steam this year, especially with, you know, people like Sam Altman and you know, everyone involved at the top of the top, they're getting involved here, and I think it's important. But the thing I disagree with is that I don't think it's the most important question to ask in terms of what's profoundly going to impact society. I think we're kind of already there, and there are so many different ways that AI is impacting people on a day-to-day basis. I mean, there was like that that NH Predict tool that UnitedHealthcare released, where now there's a class action lawsuit against them about you know, denying coverage to the elderly because of issues with models.
Yeah.
You know, Emma, you mentioned the deepfakes thing. I mean, that, in terms of what keeps me up at night, that's the thing that keeps me up at night. I've got a friend who was talking to me about this, you know, dating app they were using, and he said he found this guy that he was really, you know, excited that he's talking to, and sent me a screenshot. And I think it's just because I'm in this field and kind of know what the smoking guns are to look for.
Six
this
fingers.
Is someone that an incredibly smart person who I've admired deeply has, you know, it, starting to cultivate a relationship with. And then you zoom on the pupils, and they look like amoebas, and they're different different sizes. And if you look at it from a distance, it's you know, the fact that it's profoundly changing the way we perceive human interaction. I mean, the AGI stuff is scary or interesting or exciting or whatever, but I think it's a smokescreen.
Totally agree.
Yeah, the big impacts are already being felt.
Yeah. Much more succinct.
I love it. Okay. All right. This is sort of our final segment, and I'm actually really, really excited about this. I have no idea I had no idea what any of you were going to say along any of these questions, but I'm especially interested in this. I want to ask each of you to tell me what you're most excited about next year. You just get one thing, okay? And I want a prediction, okay? Mm-hmm. So what are you excited about, and what's your prediction for next year? And no pressure, we're probably going to come back here a year from now and look at that prediction.
No pressure.
Zizi, why don't you go first?
Sure. So my bet for 2025 is that 2025 would be the year of world models. I think there probably would be open source world models that's catching up to the quality of Genie 2 from Google, mm-hmm. and even go beyond that. So okay. That's my bet.
Are there any models right now that are open source that you think would be a contender for that?
So because it's based on video generation models, the best one now that I know of is Hunyuan from Tencent, I think. So that has a really high quality video generated. Mm-hmm. And if, you know, we feed it into enough data of user control, gameplay of Minecraft, mm-hmm. and, you know, all the games that we can think of. I feel like it's a matter of time that open source community catch up. I think it may even be just a couple of months.
Really?
For us to see.
Oh, wow. So is that your prediction, and the thing you're also most excited about is this move to world models?
Yeah. And it's still pretty early. If you look at even Genie 2, the videos are only like 1 minute long.
Yeah, really.
Right.
So it's still early.
Yeah, absolutely. Emma, what do you have?
So my prediction, I feel like Amazon is going to surprise us next year.
Oh, that's a good one.
I feel like they've been pretty quiet.
They have. They really
and
have.
And recently, you know, they announced their generation of foundation models, Nova. And they have they have models, they have chips, they have infrastructure, and they have partnerships. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited.
That's a good
excited
one.
And curious, yeah.
I think you're probably right. I actually saw something this week where they're standing up sort of like an entire dedicated AI initiative that's going to be overseeing all of those different efforts in a unified way. I mean, you know, once a company's releasing their own models and they're working their own chips, they're very serious. And it's not like Amazon to bet small.
Yep.
All right, Michael, what do you got?
Okay, so something I'm looking forward to seeing is just how the copyright debate is going to play out.
Yep.
I think that there's a lot going on, a lot of lawsuits. There's so much activity. And from what I can tell, the debate's really not settled on, you know, is using copyrighted material for your training data, is that fair use? Are there certain use cases for the model that mm-hmm. restricts you to? I mean, who knows? But that's a hot debate that I'm excited to just see how it plays out.
Yeah.
And in terms of a prediction, so I think even though there have been little issues like, you know, the Chevy Tahoe incident you mentioned, ZZ, or the, you know, the Hong Kong one, which mm-hmm. is pretty extreme there, I don't think that there's been a moment or a really, really high profile flub for us to truly appreciate the risk of these systems.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And I think it's a powder keg. I think, you know, right now, software development, it's just accepted that if you have a production system, you have unit tests, you have coverage, you have a test harness, and you have CI/CD to ensure that you can deploy with confidence.
Yeah.
And you've got issues like there's that famous issue, the 1999 Mars reconnaissance orbiter that just, it was a $125 million mistake because of a little units flub.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't think we've had a moment like that in AI yet. And I think we need to learn that lesson to appreciate that anything that's production deployed is going to need some sort of serious evaluation harness. And just because something works end to end is not a reason to just toss it over the fence.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Damn. All right. Well, that was that's a very, very good note. I agree. I think that we have not had that really big blow up moment. We've had some bullets come close, but not that really, really dramatic event that will, I think, cause ripples across the world.
Wow. Michael, are you predicting a $1 billion AI mistake?
Oh, you want me to put a value on it? Ooh.
ROI.
I'd say at least $250,000.
Okay.
I'm just going to go big for it. Why not? I'm going to laugh at myself in a year, and we can all laugh at me together.
No, be great. I think this is a lock that there's going to be a big AI mess up in 2025. I think you're set.
We'll see.
All right, this was awesome. Thank you so much for being here and for all your thoughtful comments. I really appreciate it. I'll have you back in a year, and we'll see how we stand.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Hidden Layers. This series is hosted by Kung Fu AI, a management consulting and engineering firm focused exclusively on artificial intelligence. If you have any questions or thoughts about today's episode, or if you know someone we should feature, please visit us at kungfu.ai.